There is a podcast that lies between the imagination of two simple-minded earthlings. Travel with these two longtime friends, Jimbo and 80s E, as they attempt to explore the fifth dimension. Follow along with them as they take the key and unlock the door to the vast space between shadow and substance. This podcast is one of trivia, of insight, and of sounds and ideas from one of the greatest television shows ever produced. You are embarking on a timeless journey. There is your signpost up ahead. You are entering the tragedy of cinema's Twilight Zone.
The time is 1863, the place the state of Virginia. The event is a mass bloodletting known as the Civil War. A tragic moment in time when a nation was split into two fragments, each fragment deeming itself a nation. This is Joseph Paradine, Confederate cavalry, as he heads down toward a small town in the middle of a valley. But very shortly, Joseph Paradine will make contact with the enemy. He will also make contact with an outpost not found on a military map, an outpost called the Twilight Zone.
All right, guys, welcome back to the Tragedy of Cinema, the Twilight Zone series. I'm your host, Jimbo.
And I'm your spellbound frozen co-host, ADZ.
Jeez. Please don't have internet connection issues again. So, yeah, obviously this is going to be one of those episodes that's just not fun to talk about, really. It's fun to make fun of. But before we get started, we did have a review sent in by our good buddy, Bond. So, Eric, if you'd like to read that review from Bond.
Yes, this review is from Jason B007. He writes, one of the best episodes of The Twilight Zone this season. You guys always do a good job pointing out the pros and cons of the episode. A really good job. No twist, but still a haunting episode that affects viewers even 60 years later. So, thank you, Jason B007. Appreciate all your kind words. And this was in regards to the episode It's a Good Life. Is that correct, Jimbo?
Yes, it was a Bond. It was a good review. It was a really good review. So yeah. Eric's not going to send you to the cornfield for that one. But Bond, what ADZ and I would like to do is we would like to send you a free t-shirt of the Twilight Zone of Eric and I. So if you will message me or Eric on Facebook, if you're on there, or if you would send us an email to thetragedyofcinema@gmail.com so we can get your shipping information. We'll get that to you as soon as possible. Just let me know what size you will need. So let me know. But onward, Eric, to the Still Valley.
All right. Still Valley. Let's jump right into the Twilight Zone season number 3, episode number 11. And this one was directed by James Sheldon, and I believe this is the second-to-last episode that he's going to be directing here in the Fifth Dimension. The teleplay was by Rod Serling, of course, and it was based on, in my opinion, a much better short story. If you have the chance, you might want to check out the short story version entitled The Valley Was Still by Manly Wade Wellman. This episode was released on... Well, get this, Jimbo. This would have been the day after Thanksgiving, or a.k.a. Black Friday. This would be November the 24th, 1961. Why don't you think about that for a second? I mean, can you imagine being the day after Thanksgiving in 1961? You know, the tradition. I don't know if the tradition goes all the way back, but you go out shopping on Black Friday for Christmas, and, you know, you're kind of getting in the spirit kind of like we do. I think that tradition goes back at least that far. And then you come home on a Friday evening, and you sit down, and you get to turn on the Twilight Zone on your old-style picture tube TV, and you get to enjoy an episode late Friday night. Can you take yourself back there?
Yeah, I mean, I just imagine the disappointment as you watch this episode.
I knew you would say that, but November 24th, 1961, which, you know, this brings us to our favorite time in the episode. And let me hit that applause one more time. a double dose of applause. The segment in the episode we like to call
On This Day in History.
All right, for On This Day in History for November the 24th, 1961. I can't say that I'm pleased with the first entry here. For 1859, The Origin of Species is published on November 24th, 1859. And if we skip ahead almost 70, 80 years or so to 1933, we see Fred Astaire's first film entitled Dancing Lady. Jimbo, you familiar with Dancing Lady?
I've seen it. I've seen a lot of Fred Astaire movies. Back in the, I guess, 50s, 60s, there was a lot of, maybe even a little bit sooner than that, there was a lot of those dancing movies with Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers. A lot of great movies had that. Danny Kaye, if you remember in, what's, White Christmas? Yep.
Yeah, so, that's he was I'm familiar with Fred Astaire, yeah. Danny Kaye, and all those guys is White Christmas, so. I'd have to go back and really do some more research. So, that was 1933. 1947, we skip ahead to, and this relates to another trivia point that we had a couple episodes regarding Walt Disney and how he was inducted as a special agent, so to speak, in the FBI to sort of, I guess, keep a watchful eye out for communist subversives. So on November 24th, 1947, the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Un-American Activity finds Hollywood 10 in contempt because of their refusal to reveal whether they were communists. So this was, a pretty famous case back in 1947. And these charges were levied. I'm just going to read. I didn't know who the Hollywood 10 were, so I'm just going to read a paragraph on history.com just to familiarize myself for at least myself, or if not others. In October of 1947, the House Un-American Activities Committee subpoenaed 41 screenwriters, directors, and producers in an effort to investigate subversive elements in the entertainment industry. The House of Un-American Activities Committee, or the HUAC, asked these people, "Are you now, or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?" And if the answer was yes, the HUAC wanted to know who else was a member too. However, 10 of those people subpoenaed refused to testify on the grounds of the First Amendment, granted the freedom of speech and freedom of association. All 10 received prison sentences for their refusal to cooperate, most serving between 6 and 12 months, beginning in 1950. So that was an interesting little tidbit of trivia there. I think there's a spot in the movie Oppenheimer, I don't want to ruin it, but where they basically sit him down and they ask him a lot of the same questions here, very similar to this Hollywood 10 case. So, yeah, that was interesting. So 1947, Hollywood 10, November 24th. 1960, let's skip ahead to 13 years, Wilt Chamberlain sets the rebound record. So I wasn't sure if that was season rebounds, but I went back and it looks like Chamberlain set the single game record for rebounds with 55.
You said that, and the first thing I thought of, you said Wilt Chamberlain sets a record. I was like, for sleeping with the most women.
Yeah, he's not only associated with his basketball prowess, but other things as well.
I'm going to say he's one of the greatest scorers of all time, if you will.
Yeah, yes, he is. And if I had my drum roll,
boom.
My cymbal, I would have put it in right there. Okay, 1963, 3 years later, this one is very well known and infamous. November 24th, 1963, Jack Ruby kills Lee Harvey Oswald, and I won't go down in that trail because we'd do a whole episode on the JFK assassination and all that surrounded that.
Yeah.
1966, 3 years later, the cult classic 1 Million Years B.C. starring Raquel Welch is released first in West Germany.
It's a great movie. I love it.
Have you seen the famous poster?
Of course. Yeah. Of course.
The some animal skin bikini or whatever that she's wearing.
absolutely. And it's a great movie.
Yeah, it's a very famous movie poster, and it's referencing the Shawshank Redemption. I think you guys did that movie a while back. You reviewed the Shawshank Redemption. It's referenced in that movie as well. 1985, an NBC miniseries on Mussolini. It was entitled The Untold Story. It starred George C. Scott, and it premiered in the U.S. in 1985. And then finally, and then I got a couple birthdays I'll throw in here, but in 1991, the CFL Grey Cup. Do you remember the old CFL, Jimbo? The Canadian Football League. Yeah, yep. It didn't last very long, but I remember one famous athlete from Notre Dame. Was it Rocket Ishmael?
Rocket Ishmael, baby.
Yeah, he was Notre Dame Fighting Irish, and he went to the CFL instead of the NFL. I think I was probably like in junior high, and that was big news back in 1990-91-ish. But anyway, so the Grey Cup in Winnipeg Stadium, the Toronto Argonauts defeat the Calgary Stampeders 36-21. The Argos, under new ownership. Now, this is interesting. This is how it relates to TV and movies. The ownership comprised LA Kings owner Bruce McNall, hockey player Wayne Gretzky, and actor John Candy. So apparently he was part owner in the CFL back in 1991. Yeah, so the birthdays include, for November 24th, 1947, a man was born by the name of Dwight Schultz, an American actor on the A-Team. He played Murdoch, and he was on Star Trek The Next Generation. He was born in Baltimore, Maryland. And finally, on birthday side, 1978, Katherine Heigl, famous actress of Grey's Anatomy. She played Izzy Stevens on Grey's Anatomy and a couple movies in there, one being Knocked Up. And she was born in Washington, D.C. in 1978, thus concluding this day in history. Jimbo, why don't you tell us about the cast, and then I'll give the plot, the cast of this Still Valley episode.
Yeah, it's not a very big cast. There's only like 7 cast members. So here we go. You had Gary Merrill playing Sergeant Joseph Paradine. He was in the famous classic movie All About Eve in 1950. But Eric, he was also in one of Elvis Presley's movie, Clam Bake, from 1967, where he played Sam. Eric, you ever seen The Clam Bake?
Yes, it's not good.
I like it. Oh, I like it. It's a good Clam Bake, gonna have a clam bake. Oh, yeah, it's a good one. Next, we have Vaughn Taylor. He was in the original Psycho from 1960, where he played George Lowry. He plays Teague in this. Something about Teague in this episode. He is the seventh son of a seventh son of a seventh son.
Yes, he is.
This is a famous heavy metal song, if you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, I'm talking to you, Brett and Carl. You had Mark Tapscott. He was in this guy has been in a lot of TV shows, especially a lot of soap operas, if you will. He was the lieutenant in this, but he was in Days of Our Lives. He was in The Young and the Restless. He was in Mission Impossible. He was in Kojak. He was in Highway to Heaven. He has all kinds of credits to his name. So, next we have Jack Mann. He played Mallory. Eric, he was in an episode of The Andy Griffith Show. I know I had to throw that out there for you, where he played Tracy Crawford. Then we had Ben Cooper. He played Dogger. What was interesting about him, he was in Kung Fu and BJ and the Bear, but he also, do you remember the TV show The Fall Guy starring Lee Majors?
Absolutely.
He was a director for 7 episodes of that, that's a really great TV show back in the day. Then you had Addison Myers. He was uncredited as a sentry. He was in Ride with the Devil in 1999. He was also the camera operator in the TV show Hazel. And yes, we had Rod Serling, needs no explanation, creator and host of The Twilight Zone. But yes, Eric, did you see the special cameo that we failed to mention? Did you see the special cameo in this episode?
No, you're going to have to clue me in.
All right. If our viewers have a sharp eye, where there is a scene where Joe is walking around downtown and he comes across a young man holding an American flag still. And that, I want everybody to know, is none other than a young 80Z holding the American flag still in this episode. So I thought everybody keep your eye out for see Eric in his first debut in a motion television show.
Oh, boy. I didn't know. I must have done some time traveling, yeah. All right, let's talk about a plot for this episode. The Confederate sergeant, Joseph Paradine, goes into a nearby town and finds that the Union forces there seem to be frozen in time. He learns from an old man who is a male witch who has cast a spell on them using a book of magic. The old man sees the Yankees as invaders and is keen that the South win the war. Anticipating that he is going to die by sunset, he gladly gives his book of witchcraft to Paradine to support the cause. When he returns to camp, Paradine's commanding officer is far more concerned about the battle that they will enter into the next morning than he is about the book that the sergeant has in his possession. So, the sergeant, Paradine, he was a scout. Let me give you just a few more numbers and important dates regarding this episode. I neglected to give those earlier. The total production cost for this episode was actually down a few thousand. It was $44,903.19. The dates of rehearsal were 2 days, June 21st and 22nd of 1961. And the dates of filming were as follows, June 25th, 26th, and 27th of 1961. And just a few notations on the dates of filming. The first day of filming took place on Lot 3 at MGM in the Boomtown area. For the exterior of the village, the street, and all the street scenes were filmed on this lot. The second and third day of filming took place at Stage 5 at Hal Roach Studios for the exterior of the porch. With Teague, you know, that area with the porch on the front porch and the campfire scenes and all the campfire scenes were done on the second day and third day of filming, apparently. All right. So let's launch into this baby and let's talk about this episode. I'll just tell you up front, I have very few trivia notes. Most of them comprise of goofs or acronyms or just things that they got wrong, which is kind of unfortunate and will actually play into my final, my final review. But right off the top, we open up with Rod's narration in the very beginning, off-screen narration. It's about, you know, half of his narration is done early and then he does the other half. He inserts it later. But right off the top, this still photo, I don't know, Jimbo, I may be being picky, but maybe it looked fine on the old picture tube TVs, but it just in high def, it looks really cheap. And it's basically, have you seen the movie Joe Dirt?
Yes.
And Silvertown? That looks exactly like what I'm looking at here. Like they just remade, you know, they just used a stock photo or stock footage and they just kept reusing it from way back. And I don't know, it might've been fine, but it in high def, it looks pretty cheap. In my opinion, but that's my first criticism. But a Confederate soldier, he's looking over the hill down into a valley, and then there's that still shot. And the soldier turns back a few paces, and he begins to converse with a fellow shaky soldier named Dogger. We'll come to meet him. And we're also introduced to the main character, Paradine. And Paradine doesn't think much of Dogger. He says this. The idea is, Dogger, you ain't a right arm to me or a left. You're just some extra baggage that breathes hard and splits my rations. You figure you'll shape up by the end of the war? And Dogger, you know, he's not quite as keen on fighting, I guess. I mean, we discover that they've been sent out as spies, right? And Paradine wants to go down into the valley and get a closer look. And Dogger's like, nah, we should just take the information that we have and go back and tell our superiors, because that's all we were sent out to do as scouts on this mission. But the horrors of the Civil War have obviously affected Dogger, and he's got an understanding that this isn't a game anymore. So that comes to my first question, Jimbo. He mentions King of the Mountain, Hide and Seek, and Blind Man's Bluff. How many have you played? All three? One? Multiple?
I know. Definitely Hide and Seek. We've talked about that before.
Yeah.
King of the Hill. I remember playing that. Blind Man's Bluff. I may have played it, but I don't remember. It may be a different name.
Yeah, that's the one that stumped me, too. Like, I remember, actually, when we were in, like, grade school, we'd have, like, field trip days, and I remember we would go to a park, and we'd find a hill with, like, an electrical box, and somebody would stand up there, and we'd play King of the Hill with all the kids in our class, and I remember that. But yeah, Blind Man's Bluff is, I had to look it up, because it's basically you just... I guess it's like a land version of Marco Polo, maybe. You just put a blindfold on and everybody stands around, and then, you know, you try to grope for them with the blindfold. So, there you go. These two scouts are on a mission, and the two of them couldn't be any different in regards to their nerves, I guess. Paradine says the Yanks are going up to take a position in the Chano Valley. We got to scout them out and report back. He says that's kind of their job. They got to go down in there and figure out what they're doing. And the interesting thing was, if you listen closely early on in the episode, you could hear a lot of movement and horses and men moving around in the bottom. And then all of a sudden the sound drops out, which is their first clue. They're intrigued by this. They don't know what's going on. Everything's really still in the valley, if you will, and they can't understand what happened to all the noise and commotion and movement. And that's where they split. Paradine says, we got to go down and figure out why it's so quiet down there. And Dogger's like, no, we'll just report back what we already know. And, you know, as a result of hearing all the commotion, they run up to the tip of that ridge. And then that's when the movement and everything is all quiet and it's very strange. And Dogger, his mission at this point really is just to kind of stay alive. You know, yep. He's come to the realization, like, I don't care anymore. My main mission in this war at this point is preservation. So here's another question for you, Jimbo. Did you know what a... bivouac, here, I'll give you the quote, because I didn't know what it was. This is Paradine says, so long as your yellow eats at your insides, but when it crawls up into my bivouac, I hope I'm probably mispronouncing that, but remember that slap? That slap was like, I was like, whoa, he backhand slapped Dogger, you know, because he was yellow.
He knocked his hat off.
Yeah, and I mean... boy, that was really loud. And he used that word bivouac, so I had to look that up as well. So bivouac is basically a temporary camp without tents or cover, and it was used or utilized especially by soldiers and mountaineers. Huh. So it's basically like an open-air camp. It's another word for it. I had no clue what it was, so I had to look it up. So Paradine gives instructions to Dogger, because he mounts his horse, and he's eager to get down in the valley. He says, now you stay here. If you hear a shot, you get back to the lieutenant and fast gallop, because that'll mean they're down there in force. And you tell them what happened. And if you haven't heard from me in 15 minutes, you get back there anyway. So that's Paradine's instructions to Dogger. He goes down in the valley, and then that takes us to the second half of Rod's narration. And this time it's an on-screen with a quick pan, and there's like a wilderness background there. And with that, we leave Act 1 and go to commercial. And then Act 2 opens up with Paradine riding. We've got the still shot there with the title shot and everything. And here's another question I got for you. Because maybe the story is different. The short story obviously is different than the teleplay. In the short story, Paradine rides down with great gusto, and he's rebel yelling and everything. And he's like basically going to Arnold Schwarzenegger, and, you know, he's going to take on this whole band of Union soldiers by himself. And in this episode, he kind of he sneaks in, but then he's riding in wide open space. So if there were Union soldiers, they could just pick him off. But then when he gets into town, he's like slinking across the walls of the town, and then he does like an army crawl in the middle of the street.
That's because he hears the bell and he jumps down because he thinks he's getting shot at, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And it was like, it seems like they just tried to take a mix of both the short story and the teleplay, and it's like, well, he's riding in bold, but then he's hiding around corners too. It's like, you got a little bit of both.
Yeah, Larry, you gotta have a little cover if somebody's gonna be shooting at you. Come on.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That was my thinking as well. And Jimbo, you've already pointed out an important part there that where he's, you know, in the middle of the street and he's doing the army crawl thing, and then that church bell goes off. And this is where he come. I don't have a lot here because that was another point of contention. After he discovers these soldiers who are frozen, I just think they ate up too much of the time of the episode. I don't know what did you think, Jimbo? Like where he's snooping around and everything. I just took too long.
Here we go. You're gonna get me started already. I didn't really want to go hard in this morning or this early in the episode, but I'm going to. Number one, you're at war. These are enemies. If they're all just standing there, pick them off one by one, kill them all. Let's get back and tell the general, hey, I just slew a whole mess of them. Here in a minute, you'll see that he says, oh, this is the first piece of meat I've had in months. If he could kill all these people, take all their ammunition, all their guns, all their food, all their supplies, it probably would have gave the Confederates a little bit, a morale boost. But I'm going to say this right here. Them people that are standing there supposedly frozen, man, they are too wobbly for me. If you watch it, almost every single one of them, there's a couple that are really good, but like you can see, I'm just swaying a little bit or shaking.
Actually, that is one of the few pieces of trivia I've got regarding that. And we've seen this in other episodes. It slips my mind now.
What's the one where it's the one where they
episode where everybody was frozen and
yeah,
and they used live, you know, people, and you could see like champagne glasses shaking a little bit. I get what they're trying to do. I mean, I don't know. I guess we shouldn't take for granted like some of the effects that we have today, and it is what it is. But I get your point. But there are some trivia as to how those frozen soldiers came to be. One of the lines the parodying says, come on, Yanks, you're all my prisoners. And he can't figure out if they're alive, if they're sleeping. And this takes up a lot of time as he investigates for a while. I guess it takes up at least maybe 2.5 minutes of the episode until he hears a flower pot fall to the ground from a windowsill. And then parodying goes over to investigates, and then he dismisses it to the wind at first, and then we see a hand emerge from the inside of the house grabbing onto the window frame, which is the same shot that we should have used on the grave episode. That would have been a great hand shot to use on the grave episode, but it came a few episodes later for me. Let me skip ahead here because there's a lot of time before we get to the porch scene. So after we see, actually the hand comes up, and then I think we go to another commercial. Yep. And then we come back for the third act. And the third act opens with, we come to meet the next character. We come to meet the warlock, the male witch, if you will. His name is Teague. And the old man is carrying a book that he intended to use on Paradine, just like he used on those Yanks, because, you know, Paradine is got confused by Teague as the opposition. Here's another point of contention that I guess I have. I guess I'm being picky on this episode. But the book that he used just looked, I don't know, it just says witchcraft on the front. It looked kind of fake and cheap. I don't know. It looks
well. It's probably been passed down for thousands of years, Eric. They don't have iPads to write down the spells.
Yeah. But so he pulls out this witchcraft book, and Paradine swats the book out of the old man's hands and declares, "Listen, old man, you may be harmless enough, but I got no time to fiddle around with your black magic or any old men's games." And then Teek says, "Old man's games, huh?" And then he freezes him, right? He casts a spell on Paradine, and he's frozen. And, you know, Paradine, the whole time, he's looking for a natural explanation. And the old man, you know, he, like I said earlier, he cast that spell on Paradine, causing him to freeze in his tracks. And then Teague goes on a monologue and kind of gives his background as a witch man, like his pappy afore him. "I'm a seventh son of a seventh son of a seventh son," like Jimbo said. And he just wants to talk to Paradine. He's got something in mind, and he ends up reversing the spell, and he unfreezes Paradine. And he tells Paradine that what he's done to this small band of soldiers here, this Union Army, he can do to the entire Union Army. And I liked it in his explanation, too. He refers to, I thought this was funny, he refers to Robert E. Lee as Bobby Lee.
Yeah, I wrote that down, too.
Yeah. And then Paradine says, "You can cast a spell on the whole army. If you can, why haven't you done it?" And Teek says, "For one good reason, I'm going to die. I'm going to die before the sun goes down." So he know. Now, there is a difference here in the short story and the teleplay. Maybe Broad thought it would be too brutal. But in the short story, Paradine actually pulls out his saber sword and chops Teague's head off. The story is that's the one main difference, and they probably just thought that was too gruesome for television in the 1960s. But yeah, and then he runs away and curses the book in the short story version. But anyway, he's gonna leave that. He's sort of Teague in this teleplay. He's passing down sort of a passing of the torch, if you will. He wants Paradine to take the torch and do everything that he can't, because he's going to die, and Paradine needs the book. But Paradine, he has this plague of conscience the whole time. It doesn't seem right. He says it's unclean. It's like being in league with, and he can't bring himself to say it. And then Teague says, "The devil, you're in league with the devil."
Yep.
And then the scene comes to a close. And I'm fast forwarding, of course. And Jimbo, feel free to jump in anywhere if you've got some notes that you want to put in. But the scene shifts back to the Confederate camp as Paradine reports back to his commanding lieutenant. He's been gone a long time, and the lieutenant says, "We give you up dead or prisoner by this time." And then Paradine gives his report to the lieutenant, but the lieutenant is confused at the report of the Yanks in the valley, because he hasn't heard a sound all day. You know, the Chano Valley has been quiet. So he thinks like Paradine's been up too many days in a row, or he's out of his mind, because he's like, how can there be any Union movement down there when he hasn't heard anything? Paradine explains the spell and how the old man gave him a book. And Paradine says he actually conjured up a spell on the ridge line to some Union soldiers on the ridgeline on his way back. And then in comes another officer named Mallory, and Mallory confirms what Paradine says. He's like, yeah, when we were walking back, all of a sudden, these Union soldiers were just frozen. And then Paradine sort of appeals to the lieutenant to utilize the witchcraft book to win the war as sort of like a nuclear option, because after all, the Confederacy is cracking up right before his very eyes, I think is the quote. And then Dogger, you remember Dogger, the yellow soldier, he's back in the scene, and he steps in and encourages Paradine to cast the spell. But Paradine, feeling the pangs of conscience, he reads where the book calls on him to revoke the name of God, and he can't bring himself to go through with it.
Okay, I have a question.
Yep, go ahead.
Here's one of my biggest problems with this so far. Well, up to this point. So the people that are coming up say, hey, we ran into this army that were frozen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like they were frozen still.
Right.
If Joe was the reason to freeze those people, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what it leads you to believe. Then why all of a sudden does he have a problem doing it now in the book when it's probably the same spell cast that he's getting ready to do again? And if he's already, you know, because he had to forsake the name of God, then why is it all of a sudden a problem now when he's probably already used it to practice it before he got up there?
It's a very good question.
Unless it's still frozen from the old guy, Teague or whatever. That's the only other explanation.
And the best answer I can give comes from the short story. In the short story, he's completely anti Teague, the witchcraft book. Paradine doesn't cast any spells at all. He basically beheads Teague in the story and then burns the book almost immediately. So that's where they took some liberties here with the teleplay.
Well, here's something else I didn't understand, right? He goes on this big old speech. It's like, oh, yeah, they want us to forsake the name of God. This needs to be buried in hallowed ground. But yet he sits there and he burns it.
Yeah, and why hallowed ground for the devil? Well, I guess he's referring
to protect, you know, keep all the evil inside like a seal,
okay. I would say. Okay, now that explains it, yeah.
But I didn't understand why he just burned it right there if that's what he was just on his rampage about.
Right, yeah. Why would he cast the spell on the way back? And then why would he even consider it? And then, you know, when Dogger says, oh, this is our only option, and then all of a sudden, you know, he says, well, I can't, you know, evoke their or curse the name of God or whatever the line is. Yeah, I think it was a little messy there. Between the story and the teleplay, yeah, you bring up some good issues there. But, when all comes to a close, Paradine, he eventually throws the book onto the campfire, and then we close with the episode. And I'm probably skipping over a lot, but for our listeners, just go back and give it a watch. And I'll give Rod's closing narration, and then, Jimbo, we can jump into some trivia. And this one's going to be a little bit shorter than most, which that's fine. Rod's closing narration goes like this. On the following morning, Sergeant Paradine and the rest of the men were moved up north to a little town in Pennsylvania, an obscure little place where a battle was brewing, a town called Gettysburg. And this is one that was fought without the help of the devil. Small historical note, not to be found in any known books, but part of the records in the Twilight Zone. One last question. Jimbo, have you ever been to any Civil War locations, sites? Have you been to Gettysburg?
No, I have not been to Gettysburg. It's on my bucket list.
Me too.
Being a history buff, I like, you know, driving down to Louisville where I work. I see several, if I take the back roads, I see several, you know, of them historical signs, of brown signs or whatever. And there's this one where you go over this bridge, there's train tracks there, and I actually pulled off to read it, but it was like where John Dillinger made one of his getaways and hopped on the train or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's pretty cool. Maybe I'll take some pictures, stop by and take some pictures and put them on there. But, yeah, I'm a sucker for when it comes to stuff like that. Have you ever been to any?
Yes. I actually went to Fort Sumter, where the war actually started. So that was pretty cool. You take like a ferry boat out into the middle of the harbor. It actually was pretty revolutionary, I guess, in the 1860s. There were other smaller like forts that were in the harbor from the Revolutionary War, but it's a lot small. The fort itself, Fort Sumter, is a lot smaller than what you would anticipate, like for me, because I didn't know anything, you know, I was going in cold, but yeah, it was a pretty cool experience. They got a little gift shop like inside. I think there was like 60 some odd cannons that were inside the fort, or artillery. And just a little known fact, like I think no one actually died in the Battle of Fort Sumter, believe it or not. I think there was an accident, like there was like a 16 gun salute, I think, after the South retook the fort, because, you know, the Union Army occupied the fort, and the battle only lasted 34 hours. And there was like 3,000 shells, I think, somewhere around there. I'm just remembering some of this stuff, but it was like one of the shortest battles in the Civil War. But you know, it sits right in Charleston, South Carolina, right in the heart of Confederate company, and the Confederates wanted the fort back, and the Union Army refused to give it up, and that's really what sparked the Civil War, because they tried to use ships, I guess, to get food into the fort to the Union. Abraham Lincoln actually ordered that ships be sent in to give the Union soldiers food, and the Confederates were shooting at it, so the ship had to turn away. Yeah, and so they were either going to starve to death or they were going to get killed. And after the 34-hour battle, I guess the Union ended up surrendering the fort back to the Confederates. But anyway, Jimbo, do you have any trivia you want to throw in from your multi-sources?
There really wasn't. I scoured through the books. There really wasn't much of anything for this episode. I will say this. Eric, do you ever see Squid Games
on Netflix? No, I haven't seen that.
Okay,
maybe 10 seconds of it.
Okay, well, there's a scene in there where it's got this big, gigantic doll, and basically they're playing Red Light, Green Light, right? And she'll start singing or counting down, and then she'll turn around. And if you're moving when she turns around, she takes the guys will machine gun you and mm-hmm. kill you. So I just wrote down, I said, if this was the Squid Games, the hide-and-seek games, I said most would have been eliminated by not just standing still for those soldiers. So I thought that was pretty funny. I think it's interesting for this that at the end of this episode, basically Joe has turned into the guy at the beginning. He's basically became a coward compared to his earlier brave persona. But I'll use Joe's words to quote how I feel about this episode. In the words of Joe, he says, "I don't understand. I just don't understand." So I thought that what better way to sum up my feelings of this episode.
Yeah, let me give a few trivia facts. I think I have four or five here. We already talked about this was based on the short story by Manly Wade Wellman, and it was in the August edition, the August 1939 edition of Weird Tales, that publication. This originally aired 100 years after the beginning of the American Civil War. Not exactly 100 years. That's not completely accurate. This is the only half-hour episode to be rerun during season 4, and I have to fact-check that. I don't know. At least it's not in how we watch on Vudu, so I don't know if that was just back in the day. They just reran it in season 4 like a one-off as a 30-minute episode, but that's what I have here. Here's the trivia about the Union soldiers. The Union soldiers standing still in the street. 50 men were interviewed for the freeze effect and 35 were selected. Call sheets required no heavy set or pot bellies. Extras had to be lean, healthy types with long hair and no crew cuts. Three of them were selected as Union generals. Among the men posing as still figures were Dave Armstrong, Ron Brown, and Craig Harding, and James Kessler. And so on and so forth. There, so about 35 out of 50 that were interviewed. The 34-star flag in the episode was accurate for the year of 1863. One reference guide claims that the flag showed 50 stars, but this is inaccurate. Civil War historians have reviewed the footage from the episode and verified the number of stars was accurate. So I guess Rod sent this script out to, what do you call it? I can't think of the word now. Like basically a research group to
review. Historical society, maybe?
Yeah. And they made a couple notations. I won't belabor all of those, but there are several goofs in this episode. And for that reason, like that knocks it down in my mind. You know, I think inaccuracies regarding the Civil War, I'll just go into a couple of them. Some were actual just goofs in the production, and some were actual like historical, but I'll just read a few. I won't bore you with all of them, but toward the end, Sergeant Paradine remarks that we're losing, and the Confederacy is breaking or cracking into little pieces. This cause is dying right in front of us. This would have been an absurd statement to make prior to Gettysburg, as the South appeared to be winning the war up until that battle. So if they were fighting Gettysburg the next day, the South was actually in a pretty good position up until that point. So that would be an inaccurate statement. Paradine suggests that soldiers have been frozen by hypnotism, and that term would not have been widely known at the time. Even if he was aware of it, he would have most likely used the term mesmerism. So there's a slight deviation there, mesmerism versus hypnotism. And then there is an important character error. The Union soldiers that are shown as frozen while marching have their uniform jackets unbuttoned. This was against Army regulations, as when outside of the camp, the men were to have uniform blouses or jackets buttoned up at all times. So there's one kind of goof and inaccuracy. I think there's another part, too, where as he's investigating, as Paradine comes in, he's investigating, he goes up to like a locomotive or something, or an engine car, and there's no tracks under there. So that's one error that they made while in production. Jimbo, you kind of gave your thoughts and feelings already. I've got a question for you again, and my thoughts and feelings. What do you think about this? Do you think this might have been a commentary relating to Rod's thoughts and feelings on how World War II came to an end? I wonder if he thought the lines were crossed in World War II by the use of the atomic bomb, and the lines that Joseph Paradine, those were lines that he wasn't willing to cross. Like the Civil War was, I guess, a more moral war. Like obviously it's against like UN regulations to use chemical warfare in today's time. Did Paradine feel like that was a line that they couldn't cross by using witchcraft? But you get what I'm saying. Do you think Rod was sort of relating that to the atomic bomb and how World War II ended, that maybe they crossed some lines? I don't know. It's just something like that.
I don't know, man. You watch a lot of the Twilight Zones, and Rod always puts some of his personal feelings or his personal beliefs, I guess, about how things should be. You see that over and over again, especially this portrayal of Hitler and all that stuff. So, yeah. I don't know. I don't know.
Okay. It would be kind of hard to see if you read any biographies about Rod, that one thing that made an impression on him was he was standing on the beach and they were dropping crates of food out, if you remember, and this is his own personal experience. And he saw one of his fellow soldiers get basically decapitated by one of the food supply crates that were being airdropped in during World War II. And that wasn't even in battle, but he disclosed that, you know, how that affected him. Well, I just thought of it in context of Oppenheimer's line, "Now I have become death, destroyer of worlds." You know, the whole moral aspect of war and how they, even in war, there are parameters that are sort of set, moral parameters. All right, on secondary issues here, Merrill and Taylor, I think they gave fine performances, but there's just something lacking in the delivery of the story. There's no real punch. There's no twist. And then I already mentioned this before, the hand shot that I wanted for the Grave episode was utilized in this episode. So that was a big swing and a miss for the Grave. I feel like they could have used that same cutaway. But anyway, for me personally, and Jimbo, I'll let you have the final thought after this, but the stories of the occult really never appealed to me. It's a meh kind of episode to me. It lacked the drama necessary to move it into the upper echelon of the great TZ episodes. I would have given it a 6.5, but with all the goofs and the factual errors about the Civil War and all that stuff, man, I got to knock it down to like a 6. So it's barely struggling to get a 6. And season 3 has been, I think it's been pretty good for me. I know you would differ on some of the episodes, but this one was, I don't know, it kind of really fell short in season 3 for me. But prop piece, what do you got? Jimbo, tell me your final thoughts.
Well, wait a minute. What was your prop piece?
I don't know. I was stalling for time.
Oh.
I was going to give your prop piece, and then I was going to think of mine.
Okay, so for the prop piece, it's probably got to be the witchcraft book. I mean, it's the center point of the story. It wouldn't take up a lot of space in the museum, so I'd probably take that. My problem with this episode is it's just basically a rehash of themes they've already used in The Twilight Zone. As we like to call it, lazy screenwriting. It's just something that they keep going back to. You can see several of the Twilight Zone episodes meshed together into this one episode. I thought Teague did a really good job, the guy that played the Warlock. I thought he was really good. Merrill, he was all right. The guy that played Joe. But basically between them two, and you're not going to believe this, Eric, but I actually wrote at the top of my paper here, this is a 6 out of 10 for me. It's just not very good. So I can't believe we both actually came in at the exact same number for once. And you know me, I like the history ones, but this one was just seemed out of place.
Yeah. Just a quick note on Merrill and Vaughn Taylor. They actually were only separated by birth by 4 years. So Vaughn Taylor, who played Teague, was a really old man. And Merrill, who played Joseph Paradine, they were only 4 years apart in age. So that's just one little tag there. I think we lined up on this one. I don't know. I'd have to go back and reevaluate. But I would probably say this is the biggest clunker so far in season 3, maybe. But we can maybe discuss that for a later time. But Jimbo, anything else as we wrap up?
No, I think we've rattled on long enough, because if you thought this was a clunker, just wait till the next episode. It's pretty bad too. The jungle. It's out there too. So season 3 is taking a nosedive, so I don't know what if it's ever gonna come back, even though there's some good episodes towards the end, I do know. So if you'd like to reach us, we are thetragedyofcinema@gmail.com. If you want to join the Facebook group, get on there, post your thoughts and feelings about how much you hate ADZ commentary, about how we dislike certain episodes, and how Jimbo's right on all of them.
Yeah.
But any final thoughts, Eric, before we wrap this up?
No, I don't think so. I think we're going to put the Civil War, we're going to bury it. And we're going to bury the Civil War in the sands of time and move on to the jungle, like you said.
Welcome to the jungle. We got fun and games. Well, with that being said, I think this episode's coming to a close, and that's a wrap.
And cut.
On the following morning, Sergeant Paradine and the rest of these men were moved up north to a little town in Pennsylvania, an obscure little place where a battle was brewing, a town called Gettysburg. And this one was fought without the help of the devil. Small historical note not to be found in any known books, but part of the records in the Twilight Zone.
¶¶